It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and this summer we've gone from very wet to, well, just about normal, but that means we need to think about watering our garden and landscape plants. And with us this hour to help us think about that, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
DNR Forester Mark Vitosh is going to join us in just a few minutes, but let's start with watering. I mean, first of all, how do we know when we need to water?
Well, basically, I would listen to the forecast and see what's going on, but most plants, when you're dealing with like flowers, vegetables, fruits, most plants need about an inch to an inch and a half of water per week. And if you have that, they're fine, but... So when you have a dry spell, you may need to water, but if you're getting that inch and a half per week, you're just fine.
All right. And things are getting a little bit dry right now.
Yeah,
they have been. Over the last 30 days, much of Iowa has actually had below normal precipitation, and some areas about 50% are normal. So we are getting dry pretty quickly, and the forecast over the next several days is for temperatures in the 90s and basically little or no rain. So we'll probably have to start watering probably this weekend or next week.
All right. Well, let's talk about some different methods for watering. And, you know, a lot of people have different approaches to watering. There's no absolute rule about it. But why don't you tell me about some of the different methods?
Different ways of doing it. You can use like a hose and a water wand. That's not as efficient, but that does definitely work. The key there with doing that is to make sure you water slowly and deeply. I think most people tend to water fairly lightly, and that doesn't really help the plants a great deal. So the key there is to water slowly and deeply. I typically like to maybe water the area for a while, then do something else and come back and water the area again to allow that water to soak in. So I might do that two or three times. As far as timing, I like doing it in the morning. It's comfortable in the morning. As far as doing it, you could do it in the evening, but if you get the foliage wet, you may see greater disease problems. So you may want to do it in the morning. That would be a good time. If you have like a soaker hose, that's great. You don't have to worry about getting the foliage wet. You can do that any time during the day, so that's no problem.
Well, I was going to ask about that. That water wand method, I think a lot of people find that to be very therapeutic to stand next to the garden and water it. But you can get your plants really wet that way, although that's
right.
What, of course, happens when it rains.
Right.
But there can be some real pitfalls to that, right?
Well, if you do it in the evening, right. If you do it in the evening, that foliage is going to stay wet all night long. And your plant pathogens, they typically like a wet leaf surface. And so if you do that, you may see greater disease problems. If you do it in the morning, that foliage is going to dry very quickly, and that's not an issue.
All right. Is there a problem with being evenly distributing that water when you use that method? Do you need to be careful to make sure that you're getting to all the plants in the garden?
Right. You need to maybe walk around a little bit and keep on moving. And that's what I do. If I have a long bed, I'll just start at one end and very slowly go to the opposite end, then go back and forth several times. And that typically works.
All right. Now, you mentioned a soaker hose, which I know is one of the preferred methods for watering. Tell me a little bit about that system.
Well, if you have a soaker hose, you just lay it down, and basically the water oozes out of that soaker hose, which is great. You can do it any time during the day. You don't have to be standing there doing something. You just turn on the water, you leave and do something else, and then you come back and turn it off.
Is there a formula, though, for knowing how much water you're actually delivering that way?
That can be difficult. One way of doing that is to use like maybe a screwdriver and just kind of poke it in the ground and see how deep you're getting.
All right. When you buy soaker hoses, do some of them give you an idea of how much water is delivered over a given period? I mean, it has to depend on water pressure, too, but
absolutely.
Do they have an idea?
I don't know that they do. I think it's really based more on the water pressure as far as how much water is coming out.
All right. And with soaker hoses, is that something you'd want to do every day?
Definitely not. Normally, if you're watering the garden, the key there is if you do water and you water slowly and deeply, regardless of the method, if you do a good job, most plants should be fine for a week. So if you do it well, once a week should be fine.
All right. And of course, as you mentioned, it's getting really hot. So you can see the changes in some of our plants throughout the day. If your plants are looking wilty at the end of a hot day, is that something to be concerned about or is that just normal?
That's kind of a warning sign. And I think this year, because we had all this rain this spring, that many of our plants, like our fruits and vegetables and flowers, they may have a very shallow root system because they really didn't need to go deep because they had all that moisture near the surface. So I think a lot of these plants may feel the effects of the dry conditions fairly quickly this year because of the very wet spring.
A lot of people like to use that water wand method as also a method of delivering liquid fertilizer to their plants in their garden. How do you feel about that?
Every once in a while, you can add a little bit of a water-soluble fertilizer to the plant or the plants, but make sure you don't overdo it. Most Iowa soils are pretty fertile, so you shouldn't have to do it very often. I would say maybe every 2 to 4 weeks would be sufficient.
Do you feel like that was maybe a little bit of a trend for a while to really heavily fertilize the garden, and maybe people are doing it a little less?
I think it may have been a marketing thing where they were pushing this, where it really wasn't that necessary. So I think doing it in moderation would be best.
All right, resist the garden marketing materials. Yeah. So are there any absolute do not do's, things that you see people doing that really cause problems in the garden?
I think from my standpoint, one of the things I would avoid is using the wrong kind of watering wand. Some of us will use the same kind of thing that we use to wash our car to water our plants. And those don't work well. When we talk about using a watering wand, we have something that has a breaker on the end of it that kind of showers rain or water down onto the plants like rain. The same kind of breaker that would be on the end of a watering can if you brought one. The ones that have the really forceful stream usually don't deliver nearly as much water as you think they're delivering, and it disrupts a lot of the soil. It can cause some kind of erosion and those types of things, and really aren't great for watering plants.
You mentioned the heat, Richard, and of course, a lot of our plants, especially that we grow this time of year, are heat loving, and the heat can do a lot to really boost growth and production, but there is a point at which the heat becomes too much. What is that
Correct.
Point?
Well, for certain things like tomatoes, for example, and peppers, when they're flowering, if the temperature gets too high, those flowers are not going to set fruit. They will simply wither up and dry and fall off. So temperatures typically should be upper 60s, 70s, low 80s. When you get above 90, you may not get very good fruit set.
All right. So we may be getting into that realm where we're having
right.
some pollination problems and some problems with fruit set.
Right.
Although, boy, the corn is
the
finally
corn is
looking
growing
happy.
Great.
Right. After a really, really rough start this year, it's good to see the corn get some nice hot days. All right, we've talked mostly about the garden. What about landscape plants? What do we need to think about with some of the perennials in our yards?
It depends upon the perennials. There are certain perennials that are fairly drought tolerant, like sedum, where you really don't have to water them at all. I don't worry about those. Then on the other hand, you have plants like astilbe, ligularia. They need a constant supply of water. They are not drought tolerant. So if you start to see them kind of flag a little bit, kind of wilt a little bit, they need to be watered. But most of our plants, if they're well established, like the sedum, ornamental grasses, butterfly weed, it can be dry for quite some time and they're perfectly content.
This seems like the perfect time to bring our forester, Mark Vitosh, into the conversation. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And as I mentioned, it's getting a little bit dry. As you're looking at trees in your neighborhood and around town, what are you seeing?
Well, every morning I take a short 11-mile ride from my house to my office, and I do a lot of observing. And
on a bicycle, so you have
on
lots
a bicycle,
of time to look.
And I'm usually on a trail, so I'm not, you know, causing traffic problems and stuff like that. My biggest challenge is all the little baby rabbits are jumping across the trail in the last couple of weeks. But anyway, what I'm noticing, like even on the cottonwoods, the river birch that tend to be water-loving species, their inner leaves the last couple days to week are starting to turn yellow. And that's usually a sign of some stress. And what they're doing is, in their defense, is And kind of what Richard said is I think even the trees had such a great spring. They put on a lot of leaves. They put on a lot of foliage. And then some of those species are continuous growers. So if the weather's good, they keep putting foliage on. And then all of a sudden, the water just shut off. And that causes a lot of stress on those plants. So their defense mechanism is to actually shut down some of those inner leaves. And so in some of those species, you're seeing inner yellowing. Now, with other species like crabapples, I think that's disease-related. So what I would tell folks, especially if anybody has planted a tree in the last 2 years, this year or last year, I think it's really important to be thinking about water. And with trees, you don't want to wait till they start changing color or start wilting. If you see that on a tree, a lot of times you're too late. You could actually be in trouble. So we've really kind of changed our watering methods with trees. As Richard said, we definitely want to do the water from the top down. Let's throw away our deep root watering, you know, that thing we stuck in the ground and just blasted the water through there. We don't need to do that because we got to remember the root systems in the top 2 feet of the soil. And if we have a new plant, that root system is basically where the root ball is. So when you're watering, you really just want to focus your water where that root ball on that new tree is. So don't even worry about going to the edge of the branches on that new tree. You're just, remember as it went into the ground in the pod, in the ball and burlap, whatever, that may only be a foot wide, 2 feet wide, but just water that ball. And you're probably going to want to water it every couple days, but you're just watering it enough to get that moist, keep it moist, and then give it a little time to dry out. And as Richard said, use the screwdriver method or something. If you have a soil that's maybe a little more clay and that water's sitting below, you got to make sure that that tree's not sitting in water. But you may water it twice a week when we get through these dry periods. And if it gets wet again, then you may back off that a little bit. But We used to water every 10 to 14 days and just water once, but we found that that could cause stress.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We've been talking about watering, but of course, Mark, Aaron, and Richard are here to answer your questions about any of the plants and trees in your life. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, forester Mark Vitosh from the DNR, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens and Ames, and Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist Richard Giron. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens and Ames, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron, and DNR Forester Mark Vitosh. They are here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's get to the calls. Bob is on the line in Carlisle. Hi, Bob.
Yes, hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm calling in regard to applying blood meal to a rhododendron. Is it a good time of the year to do that, being it's getting so hot?
Well, blood meal basically is nitrogen, around 10 or 11% nitrogen, maybe 12%. I would be inclined to do that more so like in the spring of the year. We typically don't like fertilizing in midsummer, and the reason for that would be if we have enough moisture, that might actually encourage late season growth, which may not harden properly before winter. And so there might be a problem as far as winter damage. So we would typically want to fertilize trees and shrubs more so in the spring if we fertilize.
Okay, so wait till spring.
I would.
At the same time, apply sulfur in the spring?
You can apply sulfur in the spring, yes. That would be a good time for that, too.
So if you apply them both together though, at the same time?
Yep, you can do that.
All right, Bob, thanks a lot for your call, 866-780-9100. And Bob brings up an interesting topic because here we are in the middle of summer. We did not talk about watering lawns when we were talking about watering.
Right.
And we see a lot of lawns actually go dormant this time of year, don't we?
They can, especially in the newer neighborhoods where they have poor soil and the grass has a very shallow root system, they dry out very quickly, and the grass turns dormant very quickly too. Now, when they go dormant, the grass is still alive. It's just the fact that the foliage is brown. The actual foliage is dead, but the actual roots and the crown, they're still alive, and the grass is still alive. And when it goes dormant, the grass can sit there dormant for several weeks and be perfectly fine, 4 or 5 weeks, and then when it rains or you water, it greens right back up. The problem is that if it persists for like 6-7 weeks in a dormant state, then it possibly might start to actually die. And I think some of the newer lawns on some of the clay soils that we have, where they have a very shallow root system, they may not survive as well either, just because they're in a very poor environment.
Okay, so allowing your lawn to go dormant can be a totally viable management method. It may not look quite as pretty as a nice green lawn.
But you don't have to mow.
Right. It's true. You don't have to mow and you don't have to water.
Right.
So with some of those newer lawns, would you recommend watering just because they're a little more vulnerable?
Well, if, for example, you sodded this year, this spring, I would definitely water just because you want that grass. You want to give the grass at least one growing season to get established. And so if it was installed this spring and we have a dry patch, I would water, and I would try to water once a week and put on that inch of water. If you can't do that, maybe you do it twice a week, putting on half an inch. And I would prefer to do that in the morning. That would be great. And if you do that, the grass should stay green.
All right, back to the phones. Sharon is on the line in Waterloo. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I'm calling regarding an African violet that I've had about 7 years, and it is quite large. It's about 9 inches across. And all of a sudden, I'm having the petals on, well, the leaves are shaped like petals, and the tips of the leaf are getting very limp, and then it starts dying. And I even took it over to a place here in town and asked what I should do with it. And they said, oh, well, you need more light under the leaves. So I transplanted it. But it didn't do any good. Mm. I don't know what to do with it. I've never really fussed with it all those years. But all of a sudden, it's got leaves dying on me.
Yeah, I would be inclined to think this is related something to the root system. African violets are very intolerant of staying wet for long periods of time. And what you described does sound like it may have gone through a bout of wet conditions for whatever reason. Maybe there was too much water in the saucer for longer than normal. And as it's such a small plant, they're usually in smaller containers. It doesn't take much to damage that root system in that type of situation. But it does take some time for it to recover from that. If it is a root issue, and it sounds like it might be, from being too wet, the important thing will be making sure that you watch it carefully and you let it dry out just slightly between all of the waterings. And then when you do water it, that you're watering it very thoroughly and that there's no water left in the saucer a half an hour after you water. And then hopefully it can grow out of it and what you're seeing.
Okay.
And it's not uncommon for African violets to lose their lower leaves. In fact, they'll start to develop like this funny looking stalk as they age. And you can repot it and pot it lower in the pot to kind of bury that stalk. And some folks with really old plants will do that to help improve the appearance. And so that's not uncommon either.
So would you put it in a deeper pot than what I had? I tried that, and I got it in a much deeper pot.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is I can't tell when it's wet through or when it's not.
Right, right.
Usually I would just touch the top of the soil, and if
sure.
it was dry, I gave it a drink. If it wasn't, I let it alone.
Right. I wouldn't go much bigger in terms
okay.
of the container, because a bigger container will stay wet longer. And if it has root issues and it's wet longer, that's going to compound those issues. So one size up at the most.
Is there a way that I can tell when it's too wet? I mean, is there some kind of a instrument or something I could get? Because I can't see how wet it is.
You can buy like little moisture meters, and some people like using those, but your finger works just as well. You
okay.
can also pull the container out and look at the bottom. And if
okay.
the soil underneath the drainage holes is dry, then it's dry all the way through.
Okay.
But I just like to dig my finger down about halfway. If it's dry, it needs to be watered.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Good luck, Sharon. Thanks a lot for your call.
Thanks a lot.
866-780-9100 is the number to call. We have Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens and Ames here, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron, and DNR Forester Mark Vitosh. You can join the conversation with your questions about plants or trees, 866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Randy's up next in Iowa County. Hi, Randy.
Hi there. So I got these two piles of, one is good black soil and it has light weed pressure. And then I got a pile of rotten corn stalks with some commoner that has high weed pressure. What would be best if I'm going to use either one of those in a garden to keep the weed pressure down or stop the weed pressure?
Well, there's not much you can do there. You can mulch the garden after you have incorporated the material, and that would prevent some weed seed germination, because a lot of weed seed needs light for germination. So if you cover the ground with a mulch, you do typically see less weed seed germination.
Okay, but then he'll just have to deal with weeds as they
right,
come, right?
Right, right.
I wish there was a great system. Come up with something, okay, Richard?
I'd be a millionaire if I could.
Right, right. All right. Wendy's on the line next in Solon. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, good morning. I got a question about my prickly pear cactus. I have it planted outside, and it's been outside, gosh, as long as I've lived in this house, so at least 10 years. And it usually bounces back in the spring, no problem. This year, the ends have bounced back, but the core plant is all black and dead. Can I trim those out? Is that what feeds the new growth, or what do I do to clean it up and make it look nice, or do I just leave it be?
If there are certain areas that appear to be maybe rotting or declining, I would see if I could very carefully remove those, just get them out of the area, just for appearance sake. Proceed very cautiously and carefully,
yes.
because they're kind of nasty.
Yeah, and not just because of the spines, because it is easy to break off pieces as you're working in there. And if you broke off one of the few pieces that's still green at the end, you'll be really disappointed.
Okay. But if I would break it off, could I try to repot it in some sandy soil and see if I could get some root on it? Okay.
What I would do probably in that case would be maybe make a nice clean cut with a sharp knife, and then maybe let it sit maybe for a day or two on the kitchen counter or whatever for that surface to kind of callus over, and then stick it in potting soil or perlite or coarse sand, and it should root.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Wendy. 866-780-9100. And Mark, I've got a tree question for you. We've been hearing over the last few weeks, we've gotten a lot of calls and questions about how bad sycamore trees were looking because of the wet spring. Are we seeing
They are looking better.
Good.
What I told most people that called, I said, wait till the middle of July.
And here we are.
If they're not better by the middle of July, give me a call. No one has called back yet. I will say, though, in my short 19 years in this area back, this is probably one of the worst years I've seen, because what happened this year is it caught those leaves when they were really small, about the size of your thumbnail. So those trees, those leaves actually got infected and they died, and so the trees just look completely bare. Most years they leaf out and you start getting leaves drop, but some of those leaves survive and it kind of looks spotty. But this year they just look completely taken over. But in the last week or two, I've really seen a lot more sycamores that are starting to fill out. With that said, I've seen some that look thinner than normal that are, you know, but just hang with them. This has happened, you know, as long as I've known trees, sycamore anthracnose has been there. But this year, it just kind of kept compounding. It was worse, but they are trying to come back.
Well, that's excellent news.
So things are, yes.
And since we've had a bad year this year, does that make them more vulnerable in future years?
It doesn't make them more. It makes them more vulnerable from the sense that this is a lot of stress. I mean, what we basically did is they had their leaves for this year, basically in those buds, and when they came out, they were destroyed. So that tree had to re-leaf, and in some cases with the early infection, they may have had to re-leaf again. So that does cause stress, and that reduces their resources. And so, like with any of these things, we even bring up Japanese beetle. If you get defoliations year after year, or if you get severe damage year after year, eventually that can cause stress, make them more susceptible to maybe some bore activity or some other things. So we hope that it's more of a roller coaster. Sometimes you have it, sometimes you don't. So they, during those non-roller coaster years, they can kind of recover and build up that resource.
Okay.
But they're, you know,
wouldn't it
sycamores,
be fun if next year wasn't a roller coaster year?
Right. But hey, it's Iowa, you get whatever. But sycamores are very durable trees, and they're mm-hmm. hanging in there.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Laura's on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question about my zucchini plant. I have one in my garden, and it's huge. I've gotten several zucchinis off of it already, but the leaves are becoming so long that they are blocking some of my pepper plants from the sun and from growing. So I cut off maybe two or three stalks that were really getting in the way of the peppers, and now the zucchini plant is leaning toward the side where I cut the stalks. And so I'm wondering if I damage the plant and I'm potentially harming future production that I might get from zucchini for the rest of the summer, if there's any remedying the situation.
No, and you probably don't need to do anything. It's just a little off balance at this point. And it'll lean, and that's okay. Later in the season, it's not uncommon for zucchini to start leaning one way or the other, and you removed a couple leaves and kind of forced the issue a little sooner than normal. You will
probably
still get...
Well, and harming zucchini production might not be such a terrible
thing. Well, I was just going to comment on that. I have a feeling you will still get plenty of zucchini.
All right, maybe you just won't have to give them all to the neighbors.
Yes.
All right, Laura, thank you so much for your call. Next up, Mike in Waterloo. Hi, Mike.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I've got a couple, actually. I have a couple of Austrian pines, several of them. And one seems to be losing branches, dying away, and they'll break away from the trunk. And they're not the lowest to the ground. They're just up, lower of center. The rest of the tree seems to be starting to brown out a little bit as well. And there's a whitish sort of fungus maybe developing around the trunk where that breakaway is from on those branches. Any idea what I can do with that to ensure the life of the tree? Or?
Well, that's a great description, Mike. You gave me the answer right there with that last description of that white, pitchy substance. It sounds like you have Zimmerman pine moth. Austrian pines have a lot of different issues. They actually have a canker disease called diplodia canker. They actually get a tip blight. So the tip blight starts just at the new shoots and they die back. And we've seen that this spring with all the wet. But then that also can turn into a canker where it kills the whole branch. And then you have this Zimmerman pine moth, which actually the critter causing the problem is the larva, which is a borer, actually gets into the wood and girdles around those branches, and then you get that pitchy substance that causes a problem. Your biggest challenge here, Mike, is you have an Austrian pine. Austrian pine have so many challenges that, you know, even with Zimmerman pine moth, if you had certain trees, you can do some treatments, but they're very intense and very difficult to do, and you're always going to have that issue. And with the cankers, you can't treat those. So the best thing you can do is I would try to basically salvage out and cut out, sanitize some of those dead branches, try to clean up as much as possible, but accept that this Austrian pine is probably going to decline over time on you. And if you have another one that's not showing the symptoms, reducing some of that material will help reduce the source, but you're going to continue to have issues.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot for your call. Let's do a quick email question here before the break. Marlene says, something has been eating the flowers on my marigolds. I think it must be an insect, as only the petals are gone and the stem and base of the flower are untouched. The foliage is also fine. Any suggestions? I planted marigolds this year because I thought they weren't bothered by pests.
I would suspect maybe an animal.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if the whole flower bud is gone and it looks like it was snipped off by scissors, it's probably a rabbit.
That'd be my guess, too.
And it wouldn't be, I mean, the flower is the tastiest part of marigold. So if I were a rabbit, that's the part I would
eat. Spoken from experience.
Yeah, exactly. So it is, if it looks like it's been kind of cleanly cut off, it's most likely a rabbit. I think a lot of people get this pungent smell of marigolds and think that animals will leave them alone, and that's not the case.
maybe that attracts them, yeah. Huh? All right, here's a quick question from Tom in Des Moines. We use a lawn service company to fertilize and apply weed killer to our lawn. Do you recommend those applications done during times of drought? We do not routinely water our lawn.
Okay, as far as fertilizing the lawn, we typically do not suggest fertilizing in June, July, or August. They can fertilize in the spring. They can fertilize in late September, early October, but not in the summer.
All right, take a break. All right, we are going to be back. We're going to take a break here as well. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and DNR Forester Mark Vitosh. You can join us with your questions, 866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, DNR Forester Mark Vitosh, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Richard Giron, ISU Extension Horticulture Specialist. You can join the conversation. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also give us a call, 866-780-9100. And let's get Dave on the phone from Cedar Rapids. This sounds a little like a philosophical question to me, Dave, but definitely has practical applications. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I was just wondering if you guys could settle a bet I got with my friends here, and if you say yes, I'm a happy man. If I had like a foot-by-foot square of grass, and it gave it perfect conditions for, you know, indefinitely. What is grass immortal if it, given the right conditions?
Is grass immortal given the right conditions?
Boy, immortal is...
Oh, Aaron can't answer this question because he's laughing too hard. All right.
Immortal is kind of a interesting word.
Yeah.
turf grass is a perennial plant, meaning it will come back year after year, but I'm not sure that it's immortal.
All right. Dave, I'm not sure we're going to be able to settle this bet. So your argument is that grass is immortal and will grow forever.
Yeah. I mean, given the right conditions, it'll never die, right?
I would say that if you always had ideal conditions for a perennial turf grass, there will always be perennial turf grass there. Whether it's the exact same plant may be a different question. But if you're always giving it the ideal amount of light, the ideal amount of fertilizer, and the ideal amount of water, there will always be turf there.
So, Dave, you're going to take that as meaning that the grass is immortal. Do you think that's
I have a hard time saying it is immortal, but
do you think that's going to settle your bet?
Oh, yeah, sure will.
All right. Dave, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number. Sean is up next in Davenport. Hi, Sean.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm wondering, well, I always use decorative mulch on my flowers in the front yard. And then the next year when that stuff gets a little bit wore out, I transfer it to my garden and I mulch it into my garden. Is there any negative effect from transferring that mulch back there? Is there any dye on it, or does it not decompose well, or am I doing any good or any harm?
Well, if you leave it on the surface, it should be fine. It will slowly decompose. The problem is if you were to apply, let's say, mulch to a garden area and then incorporate it into the soil, the microbes that break it down may deplete the soil of nitrogen, and so you may have some nitrogen issues, but if you leave it on the surface, should be okay.
All right, so I've seen a deterioration of my garden over the years, and I bet that's why, is because I've been rototilling it into that soil for a couple
of
years.
Right, because the microbes will break it down, but the wood itself contains very little nitrogen, so what they do is they take it from the soil in order to survive.
All right. Sean, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100. Kelly is up next in Forest City. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I have a red raspberry patch, and when I go to pick my berries, they can be nice-looking berries, and I go to pick them, and they just crumble. But many of them. And I'm just wondering, is it the soil? We've been trying to water them.
Well, it could also be a virus where you have a crumbly berry and they fall apart. So if you have to water, water once a week. The raspberries basically need about an inch, inch and a half of water per week, especially when they're bearing fruit. Make sure they have the water. But if you're doing that and they're still crumbly, they might have a virus. And if they have a virus, that is a permanent thing that you cannot cure.
Oh.
So it may be a permanent issue that you have to deal with.
They need to replace them pretty
much. That might be a consideration, but make sure it's not a water issue first and then go from there.
Okay.
All right. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call, Kelly. Next up, we've got Liz in Cedar Falls. Hi, Liz.
Hi there.
What's your question?
My question is about our cherry tree, and I know the best time to probably prune it is in February or March, but we're snowbirds. We weren't around. Is it okay to do it now?
I would say you can do some light pruning now. Midsummer's okay. We prefer to do it in late winter, early spring. But if you want to do some light pruning right now, should be okay.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100. Darren's up next in Waterloo. Hi, Darren.
Hello. We have a Japanese maple that died, and we cut it down and had the stump ground out, and we'd like to put a cherry tree in that area. We're wondering if we could put it in the same spot or how far off from where we plant the Japanese maple is planted could we plant the cherry tree?
I think I would probably move a few feet away, maybe 3-4 feet away. That should be okay.
Because a lot of times that area will sink on you if you get the stump removed and stuff. So if you can move away a little bit, it avoids that sinking and stuff on you.
All right, Darren, thanks for your call. Next up, Bill in Independence. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Hi.
Two questions. One is on asparagus. Years past, I put grass clippings to keep the weeds down, but that seems to inhibit the new growth. Other than pulling weeds, is there any other method? And then I have a tree question.
Well, the grass clippings I think should be okay as far as a mulch. I would let them dry first, and I would basically apply that once the stalks had come up and had gotten to a certain size, and that should not interfere at all with the asparagus plants themselves. So I think that would work very nicely as a mulch. The actual grass clippings also contain quite a bit of nitrogen, so indirectly you're kind of fertilizing the asparagus also.
Yes. Thank you. On the trees, we live on an acreage 20 to 25-year-old, all spruce, Norway, and blue spruce, 25 feet apart. The blue spruce, I know the problem with those, they don't do well on a windbreak. The other ones, is it better to trim these up 3 or 4 feet? Because we haven't done any trimming on them, and some of them are losing branches starting from the bottom up.
That's a great question, Bill. And in general, if you want to try to keep that windbreak characteristic, I would only prune them as they die. I mean, the fact if you had them 25 feet apart, if you actually spaced them, that is great spacing, especially for Norway spruce. That's generally what we recommend. When they get closer, they'll actually shade naturally. So if they are starting to shade naturally, I would just prune them as they die because, again, if you lift them up, you're really taking away from that windbreak characteristic. And they'll shade themselves out over time because trees are very efficient. If those branches aren't doing a good job, the tree actually shuts them down because they become a sink. They want production. So they'll once they start to decline or they start to thin, then I would go in and clean those. And you can prune those pretty much any time in the summer and the winter. I wouldn't avoid spring and fall, but once you see those dead branches or if they're really starting to thin, then I would kind of clean them up to make the windbreak look better. But as they close, you will start to get some of those lower branches decline on you.
Yeah, we've been cleaning them up over the years, and it makes it look better, and I thought it was helpful. The blue spruce that are pretty well dead, are they hurting anything to leave them there or cut them out?
Well, if they're completely dead, they're okay. The thing you got to remember, you're probably looking at one of the needle casts. So if you have a tree that's really looking sickly, but it has a lot of those infected leaves on it, by getting that out of there, you're at least reducing some of the inoculum of those fungi. So cleaning those out can actually be beneficial long term.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Kathleen in Des Moines. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. I have a question about, to go back to watering. I'm using a soaker hose for when I'm traveling, and I wonder about setting the timer. Should I set it for 15 minutes, half hour, 45 minutes?
That you'll have to do a little bit of experimenting because it does relate so much to water pressure, and even the brand of hose that you have could play a role in this. So you might have to take a couple of waterings and time yourself. And after 20 minutes, how deep is the soil wet? And if that's adequate, then you know your answer. And if it's not, then you can try it a little bit longer or a little bit shorter. But it's really hard for us to say for sure because there's too many other factors, in particular the water pressure, which can vary a lot.
Well, and you have to look at the forecast really closely before you leave town, too. You don't want to overwater, yeah. Right?
Yeah, it's true. And actually, using a water timer can be very nice because it is really easy to accidentally leave, especially a soaker hose on.
Right. So it's a great way to avoid overwatering.
It's a good way to avoid overwatering and a high water bill. So, employing water timers is really nice, and you don't even have to necessarily, it could be as simple as setting an alarm on your phone, but especially if you want to do it in the morning and then leave for work and let the water timer turn it off for you, that can be really nice. But using it to turn on and off, you might run into some trouble overwatering if the weather doesn't pan out the way that you think it will while you're gone.
All right, Kathleen, thanks a lot for your call. Elizabeth in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about hanging flower baskets and also potted plants that are outside. I feel like they dry really quickly, especially the hanging flower baskets. Mm-hmm. And even if I'm gone for a long, hot weekend, I feel like I come home and sometimes the flowers will have pretty much died. Is that normal? And do you have any tips on keeping hanging flower baskets moist for even just a few days?
Well, they're up off the ground and they're growing in a very small amount of potting soil, so they dry out very quickly on a warm, sunny, windy day. And so I would check them every day if possible and water when needed. And if they do get extremely dry, what tends to happen is that the soil ball will basically kind of shrink away from the sides of the container. And when you do water, the water goes between the container and the soil ball and doesn't really moisten the soil ball. So if it gets really, really dry, you may have to set that pot or container in a tub of water and have the water come up from the bottom. So
at Ryman Gardens, we water our containers every day, starting about mid-season because of the amount of root mass that's in there and the fact that they're up off of the ground. So this is not uncommon at all, especially for hanging baskets. And later in the season, you may end up watering a hanging basket once in the morning and once in the evening. Because the plant is so large, and it can, there can be some pretty hot days in September some years.
Yeah, what would you do if you were out of town for the weekend?
I would either give it to a friend. Thankfully, it's mobile. Or if it's later in the season, you can decide that you'll let it go and then replant with fall annuals.
All right, Elizabeth, thanks for your call. Let's get through a few emails here from Evan. Many of my tomatoes in my garden have been wilting. Too little water this spring seems unlikely. In addition, the garden is the first year out of sod, so I don't see how soil-borne disease would be likely. I have at least 6 varieties, both heirloom and hybrids, all affected.
Well, it could be a vascular disease like verticillium wilt, which basically enters the plant through the root system. Verticillium affects quite a few plants, everything from trees and shrubs down to tomatoes, herbaceous plants. And basically what it does, it gets inside the stem, and it very slowly blocks the movement of water from the roots to the foliage. And so the plants eventually die, as far as tomato plants. So, and there's no cure for that. There's another possibility that would be a stalk borer, which bores into the stem and feeds inside the stem. And again, it disrupts the flow of water from the roots to the foliage. And again, that may kill the plant slowly. There's no treatment for that either. So hopefully it's a water issue where you can just simply water the plant.
And as we've been saying this hour, things are getting dry.
They
are. He could be having a wilting problem now.
Right.
And tomatoes drink a lot of water.
They do, yes.
All right. This is Marion's question. Speaking of tomatoes, in container gardening, is the screwdriver method the way to check moisture? Does this checking need to be done in all parts of the container or just close to the plant? My main interest is in tomato plants.
You could use it. Usually the soil in a container is easier to work with, and so you can use your finger too. A lot of times in the garden, especially when it's drier, you can't physically poke your finger into the ground, which is why we recommend a screwdriver. But in a container, the soil is much looser.
And we were just talking about how much water container flowers or hanging baskets need, but container tomatoes need a ton of water,
right? They do. I mean, yes, they do. You can still overwater them if you go gung-ho, but for the most part, especially later in the season, I find tomatoes in containers really difficult because it will impact the developing fruit, and you'll see a lot of cracking. You might even see blossom end rot. That's why things like cherry tomatoes tend to do a little bit better in containers. They're smaller. They fruit earlier. And then when the plant gets super big at the end of the season and you have a hard time keeping up with watering, you still got a lot out of it earlier.
All right, here's a question from Anna in Indianola. I'd love to keep a potted plant or two on my north-facing front porch year-round. Is an evergreen variety my best option? Can you recommend a low-maintenance potted plant that could stay in place all year?
Oh, evergreen might be a little challenging. I've seen folks utilize hosta in containers year after year. It's a pretty hardy plant. It doesn't mean on an extreme year that it wouldn't die, and on a small
container.
On your
north-facing porch.
Yeah. The bigger the container, the better here. So, like, if it's a little 6 or 8-inch container, you're not probably going to overwinter anything in that. But if you have, a really nice size, maybe it's, 24-inch diameter container with some good depth in it that's frost-proof, you could potentially overwinter a really hardy plant like a hosta. I don't know. It's hard. That root zone's above the soil. It gets a lot colder than it would otherwise, and so you may not successfully overwinter it every year, but you can also buy a hosta for $3 in the spring, so you may not be.
It's worth the gamble, maybe.
Yeah.
All right, let's take. Can we get this on Carla in Ogden? Hi, Carla.
Hi.
Hi. Quickly, what's your question?
Compared to everybody else, I don't have any water problem because my plants are going gonzo. I've got 3 large flower beds, and I don't have to water them at all this year compared to past years. But that being said, they're invading the other areas as far as I want plants separated type of thing. And I've done pavers in between and what have you. Is there any way to kind of contain certain areas so they don't keep flowing in with the other ones?
All right. Keeping your flowers in check while not injuring them. What do you think, Richard?
I would say maybe digging those plants up and dividing them and replanting them. Some plants are very aggressive, and you have to do that periodically just to contain them. So basically maybe in the spring, digging them up, dividing them, and replanting what you want and giving the rest to neighbors.
All right, Carla, thanks for your call. Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Aaron Stile, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. And Mark Vitosh, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester. We will be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.